Title: Rural Cartmel, A Century of Change, 1890 to 1990. Interview with Harry Tyson, a well-known local farmer who was born in 1922 at East Plain, Flutborough. Introduction on tape by the course tutor, Dennis Vaughan, recorded at an evening meeting of the group in Grange on the 12th of February 1992 by Tom Sweeney. Interview follows.
And there were others, but why we've got Mr. Tyson here, we won't spend time on that. One of the things that caught my eye on David's work was the 1881 East Plain Farm, somebody Tyson. I thought, I wonder if that's any relation to Henry Tyson. It was.
Yeah.
It was, I'm glad to say. Well, Henry's been in this area for such a long time. At the end of tonight, I hope you will have extracted from him, painlessly and pleasantly, all you can, all you thought you never wanted to know about farming and life in general in this area. Who wants to pitch the first ball?
Could you tell us briefly how the pattern of farming has changed? Because at the moment it seems to be all, silaging and...
Yes, well, up to about 3 years ago, you know, there had been evolution all the way, but 3 years ago we went downhill, didn't we? The whole nation went downhill quickly, and farming really went, you know, is still whizzing downwards, and so, you know, it is in a thorough mess now. The worst mess it's been in. I'm old enough to have lived through the bad years of farming, and I will tell you when the bad years of farming were. About 53 onwards through then to about 66. Those were the bad years, because I farmed through the first ones in the 30s. That wasn't anything like as bad as this last lot was. And now we're right on the trough now, really at the bottom. Things have never been as they are now, never ever. Just from a labour point of view, the farm I'm on was 120 acres when we came there in 1938, and there were five people working on the farm, and we would be milking about, say, 18 or 20 cows. Now we are milking 90. There's my son, a part-time man and a part-time me, that is all, and we do it all. He has to be up at 5 o'clock every morning, and he won't have gone home for his tea yet. And this is every day, Sunday, weekday, and every day, Christmas Day, and Boxing Day, all the days. And there's no chance of a holiday whatever, unless I go and take over, and now I'm getting really too old. I did milk on Boxing Day, because we had the bug. Everybody had the bug in Brazil at that time. And so I milked on Boxing Day and the next day, and I really can't do it anymore. You know, it's a beggar when you've been so active all your life, but I just can't do it anymore.
But what do you say this?
Things are in a mess now. To begin with, you know, it was all horses right through until the war came, and we were glad and happy to work with horses. There was hardly a tractor around here, very, very few. And Mr. Dixon down at Meathop would have one of the very first, probably, in the 20s. In the 20s, he got one in the very late 20s and used it a little while, and then in about 36 he would get one, and always had one after that. It's rather funny that Mr. Dixon from Meathop had the first one, and John Dixon from Ainsham would be the last farmer to get a tractor around here, I think, himself. You know, he had neighbours who had tractors, and he used horses until the end.
Were they related, the two Dixons?
No, not that I know of, no.
When would you think John Dixon gave up his last fork?
Must have been about just after the end of the war. You know, it would be
just before 1950.
Just around, before 1950. Yeah, yes, I think so.
You know Rupert Repton?
Yes.
He had a cart horse called Bessie that was still out to grass on the fell. up to about 1967, 1968. Mm. I don't know what that horse
did. No, we mostly had a horse, you know, there'd be a horse of ours. I mean, I was born at East Plain. Just a quick positive history. I was born at East Plain in 1922, and we moved to Pitt Farm at Carmel in 1923. And we moved from there to Lindale in 38. And then I was in the war, and I came back and got married and went to live and farmed at Liverpool for 7 years. And we had a horse there, which we brought from Carmel, incidentally, because the ones in Liverpool were, I call them, broken-down dock horses, you know. I mean, they were tired out before they began. And if you saw them going across, you could just see that they were moving, but you couldn't tell they were coming. So I took one of these, what we called, they were old shires, what we called Clydesdales, took one down. It was a marvellous thing. And so we did have that horse, and I brought it back up here with me, and we had it for a while, but it was... There were certain jobs it was very, very handy to have. Winter time, you know, late back end, if you had some turnips, some angles or something like that, you couldn't get in the field with a tractor, not on our flat land down there, you know, you'd just sink. Whereas the horse could work under those conditions. And all sorts of, and we still had a few old horse machines, you see, so you were able to utilise those until they went, and then that was the end of it.
Where is East Plains Park?
Just beyond, do you know the Ponderosa?
The
Ponderosa, the caravan park down there. It's immediately south of there, between there and the shore.
Nice.
Yeah. And it was, when we were there, it was a big place. It was about 430 acres.
Yeah.
Then we came to Pitt Farm, which was almost a square mile. It was over 600 acres, including the fell, you see. The fell and Castle Meadows all went with it. And my father never should have left there, because it was a very good farm, and it continued to be a very good farm, but now it's divided, of course, with the racehorses on it. You know, there are racehorses on it now, and being reared, so it's very much divided.
Who did you follow at Pitt Farm?
The Dixons.
The Dixons?
Dixons, yeah. Tom and John.
Were you going to a mechanical skin there?
When we went to Castlehead at Lindale, we'd always milk by hand at Pitt Farm, but you see, we were only milking, oh, there'd be about 30, 32 or 3, I think, and there were six men there. Well, the household was quite interesting. There's mother and father, six children, two great aunts of mine, two maids, and four men, all in the house. And nothing could happen until the fire had burnt up and you could boil the kettle. In the morning, you see, absolutely nothing could happen till then.
What time did the household wake up in those days?
Oh, 5:30. My father was up at 5:30, obviously, so, and the others, you know, were shortly after. But, you see, we began machine milking when we moved to Lindale. The son-in-law of the owner there had prevailed upon his father-in-law to buy a milking machine, so we took it over. It was there, and I had a row with my father about it, but I said, well, we're not taking the damn thing out, and that's it, you know, we're not going. And so we actually got the milking machine. It was a very good one. It was an American International machine. It was very good indeed. And we soon got used to it, and it was made a huge difference. But you see, we didn't get electricity at Cartmel, at Pitt Farm, until I think it was 34 or 5. You see, so prior to that, everything was a candle, wasn't it? And a candle or an oil lamp. You didn't like oil lamps around the buildings. I mean, a candle, you could put it out, but an oil lamp, you couldn't if it got going. But it was just, we've changed, haven't we? We've got used to things that we didn't have before.
Yeah.
From what you said about other farmers in the area, there seems to be a hint that the families doing the farming in this whole peninsula that you know have changed very little over the years. They might have changed farms,
mm-hmm.
but the names, the families haven't changed.
No, they're very, very similar. The very odd ones, I mean, it really is the exception that's come in. You know, it really is very much an exception. They're all of, you know, a son-in-law even might have come in. But generally speaking, it's an indirect descent. I haven't gone so far back, but they go way back to... We originally came from Annandale up in Scotland, our little sect of Tysons, right through all the Cumbria Tysons, you know, the Cumberland, and we're not related to any of them at all. I mean, I have no relatives here, you know, only my immediate family, that's all. But it is, which is very funny. It's an odd thing to happen that one little secretary and through like that. They had farmed, my great grandfather farmed at near Dalton, but they'd been tenants right until we bought this farm at Lindale. We moved there as tenants, and then we bought it just at the end of the war between us. But we'd always been tenants until that time. Although some of them were fairly big farms.
Would you like to tell us what sort of a price you had to pay for that farm?
When we bought it in 38, I think it was... we actually bought it in 46, 47, 46, I think. We'd been tenants until then. And we gave 7,400 for it then, and it was 120 acres. But
what rent were you paying us to? Do you remember?
No, I wasn't paying the rent, but I would reckon it would be. I went to Liverpool and took a farm there in 1950, and that was roughly the same size, about 130 acres, and that was £270. A year. Yeah. It was an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
It really was a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah.
I found, because it was the farm that my father-in-law had, and as a tenant, and it was going to be built on. It was entirely surrounded by Liverpool houses. We had 250 acres of prefabs right around it, you know. So it was obviously destined for housing pretty quick. And so he'd sort of been farming it out in a way, you know. He'd been thinking, well, by the time I'm ready for giving up, the farm will be built on, and that's it. And so, I mean, who's going to spend a lot of money when it's going to vanish? Because you can't get it back, I mean. And so I had the opportunity of taking it, and he was wanting to quit. And I was wanting to get away from home, because my father and I didn't actually fall out, but we were two totally different personalities altogether. I was aware of money, and my father wasn't. And, we paid a lot of debt duty, and I mean, with a farm and with a son on, there was absolutely no need, and not to pay very much at all. But it was just the way that people thought in those days, you know. It was all his till after his death. You say, well, that's no good, is it? I mean, that just doesn't work. You can't do that, or else you'd end up with nothing. That's right. And so it was just I was sort of looking forward. And, I mean, one of the things was, I was in the forces. I was in the Air Force, so naturally, this is a terribly upsetting thing. For a country lad off a farm, you would have to actually suffer it to understand how much of a break it was to be, you know, to be thrown away for a number of years like that, and then to come back. You see, it was an awful jolt coming back. And so I was ready for being off on my own, and way out of it, whether I did or I didn't do, and I got the opportunity, and we went. And we farmed down there for 7 years. We just got the farm nicely in order when they did come and build on it, you see. And then I got the chance for this farm. My father was giving up, and eventually we persuaded him to let me have it. But and since then, we've lost some to Linda Bypass, because it sort of messed up 40 acres and actually took about 10 acres. And the Castlehead College next to me, it was a Roman Catholic college, and where they really concentrated on young priests, you know, trying to get boys to come to the school and remain on to go through into the priesthood, which they did. I'm not a Roman Catholic, but we got along tremendously well with them. They were grand fellows. And eventually I rented their land. I mean, it got quite impossible for them to afford to... Well, they had a man and a boy, you know, and they milked a few cows for the college people, and it sort of just paid. But, I mean, eventually it came that they couldn't possibly stand those sort of wages, and so it was up to rent, and I rented it just about coinciding with the time that I lost the land to the Lindale Bypass. And then, two or three years later, I got the chance to buy it, so I bought it, and... It sort of worked out very well. It more or less replaced what we'd lost.
Can I just ask you? You said they couldn't afford the wages. What difference is there in a sort of farm, you know, man's pay when you remember and now?
Yeah. Well, my first man was on an ordinary wage. The one I had at Liverpool, I had four men at Liverpool for a fortnight. I couldn't afford. And he was a really good man. He was an absolutely first-class man, could do anything. And he was only used to working with horses, but he could drive a tractor and he could drive a truck or he could do anything. And he had £4, 4 shillings a week.
And that was in 1940?
That was in 1950, we went there, yes.
Does that include accommodation?
No, he paid 3 shillings a week for rent for his cottage.
And did he get free milk?
And he didn't get anything.
Did he get these men through hirings, or when did that system...
No, no, not down there. We did have hirings right, well, sort of very well on, but not in that area. He was on the farm, you see, but he hadn't been to a hiring fair, he'd just been engaging normally. But that was just for the flat straight week, you know, just the... I think it was 45 hours at that time. The same man today, a decent man like that, would be doing those hours about £150 a week, something like that. So it really things, I mean, I know...
And yeah, he wouldn't be living in a sort of tied cottage, would he?
No, by Jove, no. He wouldn't let a man in a tied cottage today, he daren't, simply dare not.
What
about what they were paying in Barrow Shipyard for an unskilled, so-called unskilled labourer for a 45-hour week?
Mm.
So you weren't getting your farm workers cheap.
£4, 4,
and he weren't overpaying
them. No. They were just, it was a straight, and then don't forget, he was the best man there was in the valley. It was this chap down there. I mean, he was really good.
Although they were farm labourers, they were far from labour,
yeah.
They were very, very skilled men.
So man came with the thrashing machine, you know, with a great big tractor, and the thrashing box and the baler behind it, you know, immensely unwieldy outfit. And John, my man, he had very poor eyesight, actually. It was a great shame. And until after I left, and he went to the Corporation of Liverpool to try and get a job, and they wouldn't have him with his eyes, go and see about them. And so they paid, and he went, had cataracts from both eyes and can see as well as any of us. And apparently he'd been more or less blind most of his life. But he could see what he wanted to see. That's what I was... He could see how to drive on the road. And if you sort of went round and it was dark, you had the speaker out so he wouldn't know it was you. No, he wouldn't have been able to see you. It was long until you spoke. But he was a really good man, you know. And as I say, he took this thrashing machine. The man fell, the big tractor, I've got his leg fast, but it didn't break it, but by Jove, it was a mess. And so my wife rushed into hospital and got it fixed up. And so I was busy with a cow calving, and I just couldn't leave it. And we only had one cow, and that was when it was calving, just as the man came in the yard with us, and we were blocking the road. I said, go and fetch that outfit in, John. I've never driven one of those things. Well, I said, they're all the same. I said, they're all in one box. If you keep trying, you'll find the right gear. And he had it all set up, and by the time I finished with this cow, we were just ready to start threshing. And quite marvellous. And he'd never driven that thing before. But he just was a nasty fellow. But a first-class man, you know. And he's not to be compared with the average farm labourer, you know, because the average farm labourer is often... Well, at that time, anyway, they weren't fierce. They couldn't do that job. You know, they wouldn't take a job like that on. They would just sort of back off and say no. But these men are very skilled, really, nowadays. Tremendously well skilled.
Did being in the Liverpool labour market, where there was real big money available,
yes,
did that pull the prices up at all?
No, I think if the fellow was a farm worker there, and he was, you know, the boss was reasonably decent with him, and they always got a bit over the actual bare bottom agricultural wage. And a good man, they always gave them a bit more. And but they were very satisfied. They liked farm hours, you know. They didn't mind farm hours. And they used to start at 8 and finish at 5:30. But they didn't care. And you see, they were right there on the job, generally speaking. They didn't have this belly travelling. I mean, so they were over. Look at any of us, you know, sort of, who've had a job anywhere in this area, you know, we sort of more or less go within a few minutes. But, I mean, my daughter has 8 miles to go to get into her office in Oxford. And it's 6 miles or 8 miles, anyway. It takes her an hour and a quarter on a good morning. And in the car. And it's just totally impossible. If you don't get in that queue, you just go get there. And so, you know, and this to go through every morning and every night. Well, I mean, see, before that, starting an hour earlier on another job, wouldn't you, really?
True. That's what it would be. It'll be 2.5 pounds a year or something. It's 4 pounds a week.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think
yeah.
A professional chemist would have been paid
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But,
I mean, I started as a lab assistant in
1946,
I got £1.14 a week.
And
your boss would sometimes wonder whether you were worth that, perhaps.
I mean,
I went to high school, I took
yeah.
Three and a half. I mean, I was still getting peanuts, you know.
But things. Yes, they were very low.
Well, I was in the shipyard at this time trying to make money, and my basic rate was £4.03 as an unskilled labourer.
Mm.
And the electrician we worked with, or the fitter that we worked with, he was on £9 for a straight 5 day week.
Yeah.
But if he worked on Saturday and Sunday, it became about £15
yeah.
An hour, £4.03 became nearly 10.
Mm.
They were very anxious to have the work out.
Yeah, that's right.
Our friends of mine, they were just not so fitted and that sort of thing. They had a lot more than I did.
Mm.
But not eventually.
No, most of those things are relevant, aren't they? You know, they really are mostly.
It's like an apprenticeship in a sense. You know. Really worth something.
You were mentioning hirings.
Mm.
And when did they finish? And what was the organisation?
I should think the war would pretty well see them out, wouldn't it? I don't really... Did they go on a year or two after the war? I don't really think they did very much.
Where did they take place? Was it in
Alverson? Alverson, yes. Sort of just in the towns, you know, just sort of around the Market Square area. But it was a tremendously interesting thing. I mean, these fellows came on for the half year. You know, it took on for the half year at that hiring fair. And Martinmas, which was round the 5th, 6th, 7th of November, and at Whitsuntide, all the farm workers had a week's holiday at each of those two times. And on the Thursday of that week, here, by tradition, you went to Ulverston. And if you were staying on at the farm where you were, you see, there were all these people, they called them favours, didn't they? There were a feather with a little bit of ornamentation around it. And if you were staying on the farm where you were, you got a penny, one of these, and stuck it in your cap, you see, so that nobody would bother coming to ask you then. Or if you were taken on by someone there, you got yourself a favour and stuck it in, and then everyone knew that you were already taken on with. But there were all sorts of grades, you see. There was a horseman, or like a second horseman who wasn't quite fit to, you know, to do anything with a horse, and you were taken on at that level, or a lad. You know, a lad was 14, because they began work at 14 in those days, and then there was a girl, you see, or there was a young woman. Well, a young woman would be sort of 18, 19, but the girl would only be 14. And they all took on for a given amount of money for each. An absolutely first-class man, I remember, coming, and he had £18 for the half year, and his bed and board. But he didn't have a day off, or a half day off in that 6 months. He was on the farm all the time. I mean, should there be someone ill at home or something, yes, an unusual thing like that he could go for, but not anything else. And I mean, if he got a cold, he got data, and that was it, you know, he didn't have any time off. And it was a very, very harsh life in its own way, but it did make people of, most of them. You know,
If you had the hirings in November, there wouldn't be as much work to do, so there wouldn't be as many hired, is that right?
Yes, there was sort of... it didn't really vary much around here, because this was always a stock area, and when the cattle come in winter, they're a heck of a lot more work than they are. So it didn't really vary. We didn't have we'd 6 men at Pitt Farm, you see. We'd 4 men in the house, and 2 men came every day. We didn't vary them sort of in the summer or the winter, because, as I say, there was such a lot more hand stock work in winter than there was in the summertime. And so it worked out very well. But a lad, you know, would have sort of £8 for the half year.
The father did, yes.
They wouldn't take on with a woman. No, the fellow would not. These girls wouldn't have anything to do with a woman, no. They were taking on that. He was the boss, and that was it. There was no messing. They wouldn't take on.
I think the woman did, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
She was hired out at home.
Yeah, yeah. By a lady, oh, yes, a widow, yes, that was all right, but very, very few farmers' wives would go to the hiring fair. And
what sort of a fee would a maid get for a half year?
Oh, she would be on about sort of probably 10 or 12 pounds if she was pretty responsible. You know, there were often some kiddies around the farm, so the farmer's wife had to do all this, you know. Nothing happened till the fire got going, and all the cooking had to be done there. I mean, when my mother wouldn't have bought a loaf of bread.
Did she make her own beer?
No, we used to make that summertime beer, Mason's extract, wasn't it? And yes, we used to make that with flowers from elderberry. You know, this extract in the water. It wasn't alcoholic, but it was. Very nice. But these maids had, you know, they had a lot of work to do with the children. And everything was hand done. It's quite remarkable when you realise that how on earth could you spread butter that had come from a cool dairy? We didn't never heard of such a thing as a fridge. But the butter wouldn't spread. It had to be warmed in front of the fire before you could, you know. There's no margarine or anything like that in those days. I mean, there just wasn't. It was sort of very much self-survival, really. And very, very few things that you bought, like Rogers and Tyson. These people at Overson, no relation to that. But these Parkers and people like that, they had a big calling in the countryside, of course. And the butchers all came round, you know, and the greengrocer chap, he came round for the...
Why
didn't
you
dispose
of your milk before
the crossing
more?
We didn't milk very much at all. We fed a lot of it to cows and brought cows up. But we got to supplying the milk marketing board in 1934. Yes. And we, at Pitt Farm, we'd take five or six kits, rather than, 17-gallon kits, and take them down and put them on a little stand at the right at the gate there. And it wasn't worthwhile getting a horse hooked up into but we had an old float, you know, which was a light cart. Put them all in there, and one bloke went in the shaft and ran right back because it was far quicker to run down the drive. It was flat, you see, there wasn't a hill, and then bring the empty ones back, and it was. We just did it because it was the quickest and easiest way to do. I mean, by the time you got the gear on the horse, you were back, you know, and it was quite an easy job. But we were getting down 5 pence a gallon. And every Saturday morning we took a 17 gallon kit, you know, which had been, it had brass on, you know, a brass plate and brass on the top. And 17 gallons, I can tell you, was a heck of a weight to lift. We couldn't lift it. Yeah, that's right. And it took two of you, you know, you'd all your water on the side to lift it. And that went to a man who sold milk in Barrow. I mean, there weren't any bottles in those days. It was the old cannon, the measure. But we sent it every week, and he paid for it if he felt like it. Because they just wouldn't bother. He would
take it by train.
He took it down to car station and put it on the train, yes.
You didn't make any
butter. Oh yes, we made, that's where all the milk went really. But prior to this going on with the milk marketing board beginning to take it, we made butter. We had two churns, a big double-handed one and a smaller single one. The men always came in to wind that, you know, because it was very, it was really hard work getting it going. I don't forget what gallon it is. There'd be about 60 gallons as well, which is a lot of weight, and it was sort of three-cornered, not quite cornered, the double-handed thing. And you just had to have a good man. An ordinary youth wouldn't do. I mean, it would have the strength to turn it, but it wouldn't be able to time it. You know, you really had to both be working together. And Mother would say, stop, and you had to, because she was fully in charge of everything like that. I mean, you wouldn't allow a girl to mess with a thing like that. And you had to let the gas out, you know, it was whipping round and let the gas out. And then we had a big butter worker, you know, it was taken out of there and worked, and the butter worker with paddles on squeezed all the surplus water out of it, buttermilk out of it, and then mother would make it all up into pounds or half pounds, and I started a butter round in Carmel in 1929. I was 7.
I was 7 years old
and I started to milk a butter round. And not so that very long after that, I started to milk round. And because I had carried over on the bike from when I was 5 years old. I had my first bike. I agree it was an old lady's bike, and we had to ride it down the pub. But at least it would carry things like that. And it's a proud story of mine that the first customer was now called the Pig and Whistle. It was called the Pig and Whistle then, the Devonshire Arms as it was. And I sold a pint of milk there, and threepence a pint was the going rate. And a man came in the other side, you know, because I went in this side, he came in the bar side. And it was just on 6 o'clock, so they'd just opened, and he bought a pint of beer out of a jug for twopence. And your pint of beer now is £1.20-ish. And your milk's about 33p, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I know there's a lot of tax in it, but it's still a matter of where your priorities are, I think.
That's the scale of petrol, milk and coke all being the same.
Yeah, yeah. And there was the same thing about a loaf of bread, 2 pounds of sugar, and a pint of milk, wasn't it? They were all about the same, you know, and then they're widely varied afterwards. From other people. I mean, I just went and sort of began, and it was a beggar beginning because, you see, in those days it didn't used to keep too long. Well, yes, you know, there was no real jug was, could very often be there. You know, where they left a jug, and there was any water, you always washed it before you put milk in because they were rather careless. And but you'd go in the morning with half a pint and night again with half a pint, you see, twice a day for 1 pint. It was the only way you could get in. And I gradually got out for quite a little milk round for it.
But what did you manage if you had a big churn and these ladle things, you know, that you sort of got your half pint out of? On your bike?
No. I mean, a big milk round in Carmel was about 5 gallons. You know, so I would have a gallon kit on one side and a little sort of carry on the back with a 2 gallon one on, and then I would have a one with a spout on, which I could keep tipping it into. So you went into the measure and they got either a pint or a half pint, and they wouldn't let you guess. Oh God, no. And have it just right, and it always had to fill the flat, you know, come over the top on the flange. And one old lady used to say, if you don't spill it, I haven't had enough. No, and then things, you know, they did change, but of course, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest change was the war. You know, this really did alter things. There were difficult and bad years, which didn't affect us up here as much as it did the people down below. The big ploughing farms, you know, all through Wiltshire and Cambridgeshire, and, you know, all those huge, what they call prairies now, they really were, you know, just to pay a man to go and take the farm. You couldn't let them. You couldn't get any. I mean, the man on them didn't pay any rent for a number of years. They'd have them. They would just keep it together. That's all they wanted. Because you couldn't make any money out of it. It was, when I first went to Liverpool, it wasn't how much you could make in a year, as how little you could manage to lose. And that was a fact. It was just absolutely so. How little could you manage to lose? And this, of course, with the war coming along, I mean, it just transformed the whole thing. But in those bad years, up here, you see, there were always stock to sell, you see, on those blind farms, the corn, there'd nothing, and if nobody wanted the corn, because the Americans would bring it over, you see, great shiploads off the prairies for less money than we can produce it here. And they wouldn't do it today. It's only the French, you know, this. I'm against this present way of carrying on, because I feel that we ought to. The only sensible thing is to be at world prices, isn't it? And if you're not, you're in fly cuckoo land, and others we currently are. And
which, of course, this is why farming diversifies and has so many things. We might pick the your animal for money.
Yes, that's right, yes.
And what you lost on one, you probably gained on the other. But overall,
you hope that you had... One thing I discovered at Liverpool is that we were in an area where there were a lot of pigs down there. Now, I didn't have much room for pigs, and I couldn't afford to build a new building. But they used to get swine fever, these chaps, and decimate. That would kill a whole lot. So I didn't know what... They couldn't take the little pigs onto that farm, because, of course, they would all have to be killed too. So they used to bring them to me, and I had the biggest barn in southwest Lancashire. It was 38 feet wide and 125 feet long, and that was a very big barn. It was just a bit wider. There were some the same length, but mine was a bit wider. Of course, we were combining by then. You know, we got to combining all the corn, so there was only the straw. It's the pile that right around, fill it with pigs. And they used to just throw them a bale of straw and they'd have it ripped in bits. I had as far as 300 pigs in there at one time. And I didn't pay for them. I just got them and I fed them. And I just threw them pig nuts into this straw. And I had a water trough where they could get a drink. And those pigs absolutely looked after themselves. And when they came out, there were spins at that table. Marvellous, that wonderful thing is a pig, it'll keep itself clean. And they made all the mess at one little corner, every bit. And then I used to sell them back to the fellows. And all I did was got the counterbalancing money. They bought the pigs and dumped them off with me. And then I wouldn't let them go until I got the right price, you see. And then, of course, they took them back to restock with. And it worked extremely well. It was a marvellous way of doing it. But there was one thing that I learned there, and I think anyone with pigs will soon learn. You must never buy a dear little pig. You know, we were paying about sort of £12 a head at 8 weeks old. Right.
What time are you? When was this?
In 1950. Mm-hmm. I'm in there.
It wasn't much different lately,
like
the
1970s. Yeah. Well, they got up to 16. I was getting, the fellow had 3 or 4 sows, and I used to get all these pigs off him. And they got up to £16 a head. And I said, no, I don't want any. He said, well, they're better pigs. I said, I don't care. I said, you can't buy pigs for 16 quid. I said, they don't want to be more than 12, or else we can't pay. So anyway, it was stuck with a few. So I had 10 or 12, you see, and I gave him 16 apiece. Everyone lost money. If you bought a deer pig, by the time it was ready to go, the bottom had gone out of the market and they were worth nothing. Mm-hmm. It never failed. And if they were giving little pigs away, you know, 7 or 8 quid, go and buy all you could, because by the time they came round, they'd be wanted. It was a funny thing, but it always worked like that. It was sort of the opposite to what you would have thought, that's why. But as you said, pigs always were mucking at us, weren't they? It was up or down. But I only just kept those few and didn't bother them. We grew a lot of potatoes there. In Liverpool, 35 acres a year, and that was sort of a big deal.
Why did you go to TT?
I've always been TT because I started at Liverpool with just a few cows, just a few bullocks and heifers and things, and I never had one that wasn't, you know, fully tested.
When did they bring in the
test? But it actually came, it began in immediately after the war, not long after the war. Tom Dixon, you know, who would be born at Pitt Farm, I think, he moved up to Greenbank, and he was the first chap in this area, because he bought, I don't know if you remember them, Raleigh made three-wheeler vehicles and three-wheeler vans, with a motorbike thing.
Yeah.
And he bought two of those, brand new, and he went to supply the hospitals, you know, roundabout. I suppose he would go to Ulverston and High Cowley and Meathup, you see, especially where the TB people were. He supplied those because all his cattle, he'd bought them in Scotland at the devil of a price, Ayrshires, and they were all TB free. They'd been tested and they were all absolute, and they were tested very, very regularly, and so was his milk. And he had to have a fridge, you see, and he had to be all properly fitted.
That was 1946, 76.
Yeah, I guess it would be 46, yes.
Yeah.
Or 6 or 7, yeah.
Which farm is that?
That was at Greenbank Farm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Martin's there now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, in fact, there's some of the Mr. Martin that was there. And so he was the first to be absolutely clear. But it did begin then that and it gradually went on until 57 would be about the last of the 57 or 8 would be the last of the cows which were which could react. You know, I mean, yes, we've all had an odd one since, you know, but a very, very odd one. Touch wood, I've never, ever had one. But I've had one that the vet, when he did the test, said, this cow won't pass sometime, you know, maybe the next test, or the one after that, or the one after that. And I didn't know there was a right or wrong, but I got rid of it anyway, because we didn't, you know, so one could start a lot, a lot more off. But we haven't, really, there have been very, very few, I think. And we're into brucellosis now, you see, that's the other thing. And
when did that come in?
Oh, about 20 years ago. But they didn't do a good scheme on that. They should have, their own TV scheme was a good one. You knew where you were. I mean, you got a fairly reasonable compensation and the cow went to be killed if it was wrong. And so it was in your own interest to not have any. And so you didn't have any, got rid of them. Whereas the brucellosis was, well, after that, it spread a lot of, you know, bugs in the milk. But there's a funny and rather sad little story about that, you know, that when they began all this pasteurising, the days in Birmingham, I happened to know the Mental Officer of Health there many years ago, and he was talking about this. He said, I don't agree with it. I said, I don't agree with it at all, pasteurisation. He said, why not? I said, well, my milk cannot give anyone undulant fever because there's no brucellosis on my farm, absolutely not, nor has there ever been. So I said, that's okay. But I said, 9 out of 10 of the other farmers and farmers that I know haven't ever had a test. And we know that there is brucellosis knocking about and it's going into the factory. Of course, I mean, it, okay, so you take it up to a certain heat. Well, I mean, you run right headlong into human nature again, don't you? Because the lad was laid out with a girlfriend last night. And this, he's got a bit late and he hasn't, you know, you, with pasteurisation, you've got to milk, have the milk at a certain heat for a given time and then cool it again. Well, of course, it gets it warm and doesn't think, oh, damn it, it'll grow, it'll do. And there have been more people in 100 in the Liverpool, in the Birmingham area who have had undulant fever since pasteurisation than there ever were before. So, you know, I know it happens, everybody knows it happens, and it wasn't, why do they have a superheat milk? For one reason, so that it'll keep longer, don't they? So that they can take to this, and they don't. I mean, we used to have to throw it away. When I first went to Liverpool, the dairies threw it away till they got to pasteurising. And you can't tell, has water been added after it's been pasteurised? You can take cream out, put water in, pasteurise it, and you don't know. As long as you leave the butter at that level, you know. And, it, and really, there was some of those big guys in Liverpool, they made the money on that addition. And back up the job. No, I've always been, why not leave it alone? I mean, the green cup milk, I mean, I reckon it was quite wrong. And why? It's always staggered me. Why has fresh milk to be called untreated milk? And why have fresh eggs to be called fresh eggs? Because there isn't any difference except one thing. About 40% of the eggs that you eat in this country now come from other parts of the world. A heck of a lot from Holland. Salmonella is endemic in the flocks in Holland. But what was her name? She broke. Well, two of my particular friends who lived down in Kent, they live in Australia now, but they lived in Kent at the time and they built themselves up into really big poultry people. And she broke them. One man had worked 4 to 5 years from nothing into a right good way of business and built himself a nice house and really a beggar, a workaholic. And it broke him. Because they just, you know, that was it. They had to have so many kills. And I don't reckon he had it either. But there were so many people thought they had. Mm-hmm. It was a foolish, silly thing to do and it never should have happened.
Could I ask you about the breeding cattle?
in the years?
Shorthorn. We had nothing really but shorthorn. And a few Highlanders on Fifth Farm Farm, you know. We had just a few black cattle, but mostly Highlanders up there, you know, with great big horns. And funny, a few would come in winter time. And to get into the ship and door, they had to do like that. They had really funny devotion. But there were just a few that we had up there, not very many. But they were all shorthorns, really. And then there must have been a Friesian came around somewhere, because they began to have some blue ones, as we call it, you know, this lightish blue and white. Like a shorthorn, but blue and white, you know, rather than brown or red and white. But there were all shorthorns in here, and then they got a few Ayrshires, but Major Dixon had Ayrshires, which is a very, very good milk cattle, but not very good for beef beasts, really. They didn't get to the sort of milk to produce milk, and that's what they did. But and then we started getting Friesians, and the old Friesian was a pretty rounded out sort of animal. Now we've changed and gone on to the Holstein, which is sort of really Canada and America have developed the Friesian, and they've gone for these big raw boned cows, which give an immense amount of milk, of course, good quality milk and a lot of it. And not like the little story about the, you know, most of the Scotsmen were red hot Ayrshiremen, you know, and if they saw a black and white cow, they'd think it was those, you see. But they gradually began to change, you see. And one chap said to his neighbour, "So you've got a couple of black and white ones, you're going to follow them." "Oh, well, there's that." "Oh, no, just keep those for swilling the units out."
If you're producing an awful lot of milk, what's happening now? Because of the coat?
The quota is, you know, it's its own thing. But it just means that you do need to keep less cows, actually. And these big cows are making the best possible use of the food. You know, they're becoming more like a mini factory. You know, they really do. And the bred to it, and breeding has been all important. We're sort of running around the, mothers, and I mean, they know, there's an all written down from way back, and all these pedigree fellows have it, they can follow them right back, older than a lot of their owners.
When did the quarter start?
83, wasn't it? I think it was 83. It was absolute nemesis, and the raving madness of the wildest sort. It couldn't possibly have been dafter than do that. Because we, at the time that they were introduced, we in Britain were producing about 79% to 83%, somewhere in that region, of our dairy product requirements. And we were importing almost all the rest from New Zealand, with a little bit of Danish butter, but not a lot, really. Then at that time, France was producing 195%, Holland 240%, Denmark 185%.